Muchas gracias a todos, muchas gracias presidente, muchas gracias presidenta de la Fundación, muchas gracias a todos los que habéis venido a hablar sobre libertad económica en un momento esencial, en un momento esencial en el que magnificando y aumentando con el espejo de lo que es la demagogia, se está intentando vender la mayor incongruencia que existe en el mundo, que es intentar vender como espacio de libertad el intervencionismo, intentar vender como prosperidad el ataque a la iniciativa privada y el ataque a la prosperidad y al mérito individual. Estamos en una época en la que informes como este que presenta la Heritage Foundation son esenciales. Y son esenciales porque cuando nos encontramos con épocas en las que a lo mejor es más complicado entender los movimientos de la economía, es más difícil entender cuáles son las grandes tendencias que nos llevan hacia el futuro, el ser humano quiere progreso, pero le tiene miedo al cambio. Y a veces el cambio se utiliza como subterfugio para defender la regresión, la vuelta al pasado. Glorificar un pasado que ninguno de los que habéis vivido ese pasado considera como fantástico y desde luego magnificar como grandes oportunidades lo que nunca ha funcionado. Las soluciones mágicas que pueblan los populismos que mencionaba el presidente Aznar y que parecen muy sencillas soluciones que parece que se le ha ocurrido a una persona para problemas muy complejos. El intervencionismo como propuesta de libertad, por supuesto, nunca genera libertad, solamente genera represión. El acabar o el atacar la iniciativa privada y la iniciativa meritocrática para un supuesto igualitarismo que lo único que se convierte es en demagogia y, por supuesto, como estamos viendo en tantos países, en mayores dificultades para todos. Pero, sobre todo, merece la pena este informe del que vamos a hablar y me vais a permitir que traslade el debate al inglés porque la amenaza es muy grande y esa amenaza debe combatirse cada día. Decía Ronald Reagan, y ya paso al inglés, Ronald Reagan used to say that freedom is nothing that we can take for granted, that we need to fight for every day because the enemies of freedom, they are always on the prowl. I believe that this report that has been published now is essential because what it does is to highlight the inefficiencies of some of the countries that are being used by others to as optimal solutions. But I think that it's also very important because of the, not just because of the ranking, but because of the details of that ranking and how those metrics are used to put together the place of each of the countries in economic freedom. If you were to summarize the findings of this 2017 report, what would be, in your view, the main items that you would say the casual reader would find more intriguing, more interesting?
Mm. Well, primero, muchas gracias, Daniel. y muchas gracias a la Fundación Rafael del Pino y también a FAIS por esta invitación para Heritage presentar el Índice de Libertad Económica otra vez en Madrid. Estoy encantado de estar de nuevo aquí en la hermosa ciudad de Madrid. Ya que no hablo español con fluidez día por día.
Habla maravilloso.
Entonces, voy a continuar en inglés. So I would say that the message of this edition is that economic freedom has recovered in the world to a little bit higher level than it was before the financial crisis of 2008, but that now it needs to resume a positive trajectory, I would say, and that the interventionism of many governments, including and maybe especially by the United States during the Obama years, was a real setback to economic freedom. Too much government spending, and especially too much debt. And because of so much government spending, too many opportunities for cronyism and corruption that were created whenever government gets involved in the marketplace. And so that would be my takeaway, just in general.
This is a very interesting thing that you're saying, because when you come to the European Union in particular, when you read the media, the Obama administration is actually perceived as one that has accomplished tremendous things for the country, and it's very rare to read in the economic press, let alone in the mainstream media in the European Union, that debt increased by almost $10 trillion. That at the same time there was a $1.5 trillion increase in taxes, and that it actually was the biggest transfer of wealth seen from the middle class and the saving communities to government. What would you consider to be the lesson of that period, particularly because you've seen also the reaction in the past elections and what citizens are actually demanding? Because it's also something that, when it's used as a solution, should be also a lesson for the European Union that finds itself in front of tremendous reforms ahead.
Yeah, I think, well, it is apparent that the government, when a government creates an entitlement, it's very hard to take it away. Hmm. And entitlements are at the center of the political debate now in the United States. But they are, in general, they represent a socialist, very inefficient way to provide services to people. And so we're having that debate now as we speak about the replacement of Obamacare and a reform of our tax structure in the United States. But you're right, we have gone too far in a fairly hard left direction. It will be back to difficult to put us back on the track, but that's what we at Heritage are trying to do. So I think for Europe, the message is that this sort of welfare state problem is ultimately not sustainable, and that is the issue that politicians really should be confronted with, I think, and that's what we try to do.
Mm-hmm. One thing that is also relevant about the report is that when you look at the findings of the report, most of the countries that when we have debates with other economists, social democrat economists, communist economists, which is an oxymoron, one of the things that's most amazing is that the countries that have the highest level of economic freedom are actually the ones that have the best ratios in terms of both productivity, in terms of salaries for the middle class, in terms of prosperity in general. While those countries in which we have seen a constant erosion of the metrics of economic freedom not only are coming down in the list of your report, but they're also coming down in the metrics that these commentators are actually looking for the type of society that they desire. So I wonder, out of the different items that put together the ranking of a country in economic freedom, what would you say that separates in a clearest form the difference between those countries in the OECD that actually fare better in all those metrics of social welfare, real welfare, mm-hmm. Well-being, relative to the ones that have been deteriorating?
Good questions. I think seems to me communist economists would be the sacerdotes of communism. Right? Maybe this is a good point to kind of review some of our some of the nuts and bolts and mechanics of the index. The four pillar areas, rule of law, size of government, efficiency of government, and openness of a country to the outside world, to the globalized economy for trade and investment. And so this is what we look at. We look at property rights, the efficiency of the judicial system, the anti-corruption efforts of a government to deliver clean government, we look at the tax burden as a percent of GDP, of the public spending at all levels of government as a percent of GDP, and the level of debt as a percent of GDP. And then we look at the ability of private business to operate in the country. We look at the labor laws and the stability of the currency, and also the intervention of the government in the form of price controls. And finally, the openness of the government to trade and investment, the openness to international banks. So, and we use international sources, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, World Economic Forum, World Trade Organization, the Transparency International Corruption Perceptions Index. And so those are the factors. And so how this shows the, as you were saying, the supremacy of countries with higher economic freedom in so many areas. And not only once they get higher economic freedom, they tend to keep it. They have a momentum, mm-hmm. as exactly. economists know. And that's so important, because otherwise, if you lose the opportunity of growth, it's gone forever. So changing policies to promote economic freedom is going to help not just now, but for years to come, where you have higher levels of prosperity with more economic freedom according to these correlations. You have people being lifted out of poverty permanently, really, if, as long as they're willing to work. And social indicators, social goods, health, education, environmental quality, clean air, water, streets. And so those are all also positively correlated, social progress with economic freedom, which is exactly your point. Here are the leaders around the world, and here are the top 10 and the bottom 10. It's pretty obvious, two different, very different groups of countries, which we can talk about later, but just to get through some of these. And the world map, which is on the handout by FICE, the heat map, and in Europe, where is the most economic freedom in green versus the least in red. So we can, if you want to, that's kind of a good place to stop, I think.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back to the slide in which you show the countries with the highest level of economic freedom and the ones with the least economic freedom. Mm-hmm. It is one thing that is actually taken out of the debate many times is, as you very well mentioned, is monetary freedom. Mm-hmm. Is that the countries in which there is a tremendous amount of intervention from the government in the currency and with and in the amount of currency that is issued are actually not only less prosperous and less well off, but they also got worse and worse. And this is an important factor, because they've been going from some of these countries have been reading this report for many years, and these countries have been going down the list.
Yes.
And one, you're actually going to have to go to a different number next time. But this is very important, because there is a whole new, actually not new, but there is a whole new magic solution agenda, particularly in Europe with Mélenchon, Le Pen, Podemos, Syriza, about, oh, and if we issue all the currency that we want, if we just if we just get rid of this straitjacket that the euro is, everything will be all right. Because we were just
didn't they try that in the Weimar Republic?
Exactly. But the
didn't have a good outcome.
That's why it's so funny. It's called modern monetary theory. Mm-hmm. It has nothing modern to it, because it's been done over and over again since Nero decided to have the brilliant idea of putting a little bit of steel in the silver coins. But funnily enough, it sort of comes across as something that would be adequate, that we would lose the risks of austerity by issuing currency as much as we wanted. Mm. So I think it's an important factor that you show that monetary freedom is an essential element of preserving wealth, preserving social well-being, and also I think you touched upon a subject that is very important, is that because once it is destroyed, it's very, very, very difficult to get out of it. Mm-hmm. It takes many, many years, as we are seeing right now with Argentina, to get out of a massive monetary hole.
Yeah, that's right. And inflation is the cruelest tax. It's a really theft and of people's hard-earned wealth, that And that is one of the core, you know, principles of the Heritage Foundation and of economic freedom, is that this is people's own property, and they decide how much they give the state. The state doesn't decide how much they get to keep. I think that's really a kind of a core difference we have.
In the report as well, you were mentioning a heat map. Right. And I'm interested about that heat map within the European Union. Mm-hmm. Because in this misguided strive for equality at all costs, one thing that we find, particularly in the European Union, is that there is a debate that why are we not all living exactly like the Germans or living exactly like the French. I think that there's an important factor about what governments have been able to can do, even within a system in which monetary policy and part of the fiscal policy is subcontracted to a larger entity. So I wonder, what would you think would be the main point to highlight for the European Union, particularly with the challenges that we face ahead?
Well, I would start with a case study of the United States under Obama, and that would be that probably one of the greatest contributors to the election of Donald Trump was the unhappiness and the feeling of being left out by especially people in the middle of the country. When under huge spending by Obama that ran up huge government debt and led to economic stagnation, with companies worried about investing because they didn't know what new regulation would come along, there was in fact created more inequality.
Exactly.
And the people on the inside, on the coasts in the Silicon Valley and New York and places, did very well, but people in the middle felt left behind. And so they reacted by, really saying we want to have a new try at this. We don't think this worked. No. So, I think to the extent that that could be applied in Europe, there are probably a lot of parallels there. But I think having a central bank that is independent and maintains the value of the currency and doesn't deflate it, inflate it, that is very important, and that's very hard to do. Many people have tried, the gold standard and over the centuries, but it requires political will and discipline. And so if you have a case where a country is using a currency that it doesn't fully control the value of, that's actually a blessing. As we found in Ecuador, it's a dollarized economy, so Rafael Correa, who is a buddy of the late Hugo Chavez, but he had limits imposed on him by that fact. The tendency of politicians is to spend money and buy votes. And that's the case everywhere. So putting limits on that and making transparent arguments that to really highlight the negative results, as we're doing here.
Exactly.
I think that's important.
Yeah, I think that is. I completely agree, because you touched upon something that I think is very relevant, is that extreme demand-side policies, fiscal and monetary policies, have actually contributed to an increase in the inequality. But at the same time, it's not just that people at the top are earning more and people at the middle or the bottom are making more or less the same. No, the problem that you find is that the ability with financial repression, the ability of the middle class to get on the ladder and move upwards has been limited dramatically because the increasing wealth is constantly diluted through monetary policy, and the improvement in the savings are being eroded by fiscal policy.
Right.
So, and you end up getting, I remember that I was in my wife and I, we were in the United States, and there was a debate before the elections, and they were saying there was a debate between conservatives, it's in the Republicans and the Democrats. And there was a commentator, I think it was in Fox News, that said, no, it's between the guys that pay and the guys that receive. That is the debate. It's a big difference. Huh?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, instead of the analysis of the elections that we have seen here in the European Union that basically simplify everything, saying that the guys that voted for Trump are the guys that don't read, don't travel, and don't whatever. Think about it's the people that actually have continuously been creating a little bit of wealth to transfer to their family, to create a little bit of prosperity for the family, regardless of whatever the government was, and found themselves in a situation in which they couldn't do it anymore. The American dream was taken away from them.
Right.
I think that what it's also very important about this report is that what it highlights is that if what you want actually is New Zealand, I mean seriously, is a country in which there is very little inequality, and at the same time there is respect for wealth and respect for savings, mm-hmm. you get much better results in terms of education,
yeah.
in terms of the level of social spending as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talk a lot in the European Union, and I hate this, by the way, we talk a lot about spending relative to the rest of the European Union, so it becomes a trick.
Mm-hmm.
The French spend a lot more, so they increase the average, and everybody says that they are below the average, so they increase the average more. It's fantastic, mm-hmm. no? And then the French increase it even further, maybe not now, let's see what happens, but they increase it even further, and we come in an economy in which the fixed costs are so gigantic that you're just literally always putting another stone that doesn't allow you to recover when there's an economic cycle.
Right.
One of the things that I find very interesting about the tendency of this report in the since the crisis is how the countries that have gotten earlier and with more respect to economic freedom have gotten earlier out of the crisis than those that actually changed their priority from getting out of the crisis to perpetuating the imbalances.
Yeah, like Ireland got out.
Exactly.
They did the tough decisions. And the U.S. didn't enough, really. Mm. They didn't deal with the toxic assets. There were too many bailouts, which also contributed to a lot of unhappiness by people in the middle of the country. So, you know, you take the case of New Zealand, that famous case where they had, 20 years ago, traditional kind of left-of-center views of the agriculture sector, very similar to the really awful, you know, farm subsidy bills we have in Europe and the United States. And the New Zealand government decided, that's it, we're going to cut all subsidies, no more subsidies to agriculture. They now have the most productive agriculture sector in the world.
Exactly.
With no subsidies whatsoever. And it's a major factor in their really very, very high degree of economic freedom. So
I think that that's a very important factor, because when people criticize economic freedom as a metric, mm-hmm. they tend to say, well, this means more cronyism, more crony capitalism. Which is actually the opposite.
It's the opposite.
It is the opposite. And I think that that's an important fact, because crony capitalism doesn't happen without government intervention. It's
right.
impossible to get crony capitalism unless you have the so-called strategic sectors that a government decides to protect at any cost.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why 5 of the 10 wealthiest counties in the United States are around the Washington, D.C. area. this is not an accident. So you have the big companies that can afford it, have huge lobbying staffs. There are as many lobbyists, registered lobbyists in Washington as there are staff members of Congress,
mm-hmm.
which is an interesting kind of balance, one-to-one. And that is a problem, and that's something the Heritage Foundation took a very principled and courageous stance against export subsidies
mm-hmm.
with our Export-Import Bank, because it was giving an industrial policy awarding winners and losers, in this case Boeing and General Electric and others, who are very fine companies, but they can afford to borrow money in the private markets. They don't need subsidies from the taxpayers.
Exactly.
And this is, it's very insidious, as you say, kind of this mission creep, this incrementality of having the government more and more in charge, having people more and more dependent and fearful. Part of the problem in the middle of America is people now are hooked on welfare payments at the state, local level, and federal, And they're afraid to move. They're afraid to go where they know there are more opportunities in the rest of the country, which is thriving compared to some of the areas that have older industries.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thomas Sowell always used to say that that existentialism makes poverty, it perpetuates poverty because it makes it easy and it makes people fearful, not just of change, but of opportunity.
So, and in fact, no one is really in poverty in the United States.
I mean, that's it.
The lowest income levels would be middle class in anywhere else in the world. And the other side never wants to discuss that issue.
That's another very important thing, because we like to, the political utilization of poverty as a concept has gotten to a point in which here in Spain we're reading things like at risk of poverty. Look, I'm at risk of falling down the stairs, but I'm not falling down the stairs, believe me, or at least I'll try. It's not the same. It's not the same to have 5.6% poverty in Spain with such a crisis than to have 20% of people, and how you measure that risk of
being. Marxists are always, they always use class warfare and jealousy as their modus operandi, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, with this, we're going to have if anybody has a question, feel free to raise your hand.
And if you want me to talk about Spain in particular, I could.
That would be phenomenal, because that's the point that I think we want to address.
Just very briefly.
Absolutely.
With my colleague, Diego Sanchez de la Cruz, we published a little paper last week, and he's with the Smart Regulation Forum, called Spain Moving from Recovery to Greater Economic Freedom, and so, which is really a more detailed look at our 2017 index report about Spain, where we talk, we have something happened here. We have the total score of 63.8, which is above the minimum score you need for to be moderately free in the world, which is 60. So, but there's work to do. The tendency that has been down. This is much lower, and this is before the President Aznar's era, but in that era, the scores were much higher. And so they have declined. And most recently, the problem has been the judicial system, as we talk about in this paper, with very slow justice. The justice system is good, and it's transparent, and it's honest, but it's slow.
Yeah.
And so that has downgraded the score on the effectiveness of the judicial system. And the other big problem, as you've been talking about, is the spending and the deficit spending and the debt, which we have also the same problem in the United States for 8 years of Obama. So very low scores worldwide on that. You could see 164, 150, 164. And the debt, that fiscal health score indicates 100% of GDP in debt for Spain. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. is very, very high also.
Yeah.
Those are some of the findings. Then I guess there's another slide maybe we don't have here, but shows on the efficiency of regulation. And something we talk about in this paper is the problem with the 17 autonomous communities all issuing, a total, I think, of 1 million pages a year of new regulations that are burdens on business, have really a threat to the functioning of the single market of Spain. So that's something that we've noted in the paper, just the problem with regulation. And President Trump has said that if his government issues a new regulation, it will have to. It can only do it if it cancels two regulations from the Obama era. So that's our approach in the United States on that. In the other area, Spain does get very good results on openness of its markets for trade and investment and its banking sector. But that is just some things that we've highlighted. The labor market, which the Partido Popular has made a lot of progress on flexibilizing the labor market, but there are still some issues, like the one with this the royal decree being stopped about the ports that the European Court of Justice talked about, which we note in our paper. So that's just a kind of a summary of, and here we are with the southern tier of the European Union and the scores over the period of the last 10 years. And so I don't know if that's. Oh, there's the other one here. So the regulation that I've been discussing. We used the World Bank Doing Business Survey for our Libertad de Empresa score. So I think that's probably it.
So the finding basically is that there's improvement to continue to be done. And but what I would also like to highlight from the report is the cost of not doing it in for so many economies. Mm-hmm. You're mentioning in the United States that the regulation increases in the past 8 years had a cost of $45 billion a year. $45 billion is a lot of money. Yeah. It's the entire budget increase in military spending that Mulvaney wants to increase. Right. So so there's actual economic risk from not undertaking the reforms that yes. will improve the situation. And I think that that's because I think it's an important message for a country that is fine, that is growing steadily, is growing mm-hmm. above expectations, yep. creating employment, etc. But we need to think of working with that we need to do and we can do more. No?
In fact, and that's a very good point, and it reminds me that Secretary Shultz, George Shultz, who was a famous and now very old professor at Stanford, but was Secretary of State and Treasury and Labor a long time ago, he recently said last week, the problem, and one of the things that propelled the populist wave that propelled Trump into office was anger or upset about globalization, trade, loss of jobs, and the trade deficit. And so that's the risk we were going to talk about. One of the things today is about the risk of protectionism. And one of the factors there is the trade deficit in the United States is being driven by the budget deficit.
Exactly.
Because here you have countries like China buying trillions of dollars of our debt in the form of T-bills. And so where those dollars have to go somewhere, they have to go home someday. And so if you want to end the trade deficit, and trade deficits are not, as libertarian, liberal economists, we know that trade deficits are not bad. And in fact, they make for a higher standard of living. They create jobs, imports, lower cost inputs in the 21st century supply chain. They're not the enemy.
Of course.
But the enemy is the deficit, is too much spending by government. And really, that's where we want to bring the conversation back to. Not only in the United States, but around the world.
Because when you have this discussion about deficits, particularly in the European Union, it's used as a tool to grow. Deficits are not a tool to grow. Deficits are more taxes in the future.
That's
you
right.
know, which is like any family will understand, is that what you don't spend this today, you will have to get the revenue somewhere, and it's going to come either from taxes, and obviously, inflation is taxation without legislation, as Milton Friedman used to say. So there's two ways of doing it, no? But it's the same level of impact. I think that to wrap it up a little bit, what I would like to highlight is how important it is to measure economic freedom, not just because, not from where we are, if we're happy with where we are, but where we need to be. Mm-hmm. One thing that worries me about the European Union, about some countries in the world, is that instead of looking at the leaders to improve, you're basically comparing yourself with the countries that have done worse. And I'm thinking France compares itself now with the periphery of Europe instead of comparing itself with Germany, the US, the UK, or Japan. I think it's an important factor because what we want to achieve is higher prosperity, better salaries, more economic growth, and a stronger achievement of improvements within an economic cycle, we need to pay a lot of attention to this. So I really, really thank you for this fantastic report. I don't know if there's any question in the audience. Is there any question?